He's going to introduce Michael, and he's going to introduce you with the upcoming events. Sure. And other than that, thank you for coming, and thanks for your support, and have a great evening. Okay, I'm going to be brief because nobody came to see me. As Todd said, I'm the executive director here, and I want to welcome you to another in our series of the Legends of Air and Space. The series is in its seventh year, and we've brought quite a few different luminaries in the air and space history to the museum, and tonight's no different. Before I begin, I do have to give you a few commercials. Let's see. On February 5th, which is next Friday, we're doing a wine tasting called the Tour de France. And you'll be able to meet some of France's most talented winemakers. And it's a small fundraiser for the museum, but there'll be hors d'oeuvres, a little bit of wine. It's going to be in the Hempstead Plains Gallery, so it's going to be next to the Blériot. And as I said, it's only $25, so it'll help us raise a little bit of money for the museum. In addition, tonight's kind of the kickoff of kind of our three-month salute to the Hubble telescope. Having Mike here is a good kickoff for that. During the February vacation break, we're going to dedicate the whole week to the Hubble telescope. We'll have a lot of free family activities here at the museum, so if you're not going to Florida and you're going to be around for a while, come out to the museum and enjoy all of that. Which leads into March when a new movie, IMAX film on Hubble, starring Mike Massimino, will be opening here at the museum. And it's just part of what we're trying to do on a regular basis here, which is focus on timely topics. And Hubble is certainly one. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Mike if you don't know. As you know, he's a Long Islander. He's also a former volunteer here at the Cradle. He did a number of presentations when it wasn't a museum. It was just a bunch of dusty old planes and some of the hangars here. So he's familiar with the museum. He is now a certified movie star, having starred in the Hubble feature film, which will be coming out. And he can also lay claim to being the title as probably the best repairman in the world. Most of you know he is a graduate of the Franklin Square School System. Anybody here from Perry High School? Went to Columbia and MIT, joined NASA in 1996, and worked initially in NASA's robotics and EVA or spacewalking branches. His first spaceflight was aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia in 2002 to upgrade the Hubble. And his most recent mission last May on Atlantis served as the final repair mission to Hubble. In all, he's logged 571 hours in space, a total of 30 hours and 4 minutes in spacewalks in his career. And I just found out that their crew on the last mission, I guess combined, had the most EVAs in NASA's history. So to share his fascinating adventures in space, please welcome a good friend of the museum, Mike Massimino.
It's my pleasure to be here. I guess I have to use this mic. Okay. So my friends, thank you, Pilot Island United. I was running a little bit late, and I was trying to call the museum, but I didn't have anybody's cell phone, so no one was answering the phone. So I called Pat. I said, Pat, if you get here before I go, tell them I'm coming. So I'm glad she had made it as well. But it's fun to see. I see a lot of my friends, so this is fun. I'll try to go really quick with you so we can visit. But you have to listen to me for a little while first. I was going to tell you about what I did. It was a great trip. I see a lot of kids here. My message to you is that if there's something you find that you like doing and you're at your age now, we got some real little guys here and gals. As you grow older, whether you find something that you find interesting as a young person in elementary school, high school, if you're a college student, whatever it might be, there's something that really catches your attention, I would suggest that you pursue it. For me, I was very young when they put people on the moon, and that really kind of caught my imagination as a young boy. Didn't really think much about what I was going to do when I was in high school. A lot of people can attest to that. But I liked math and science, studied engineering in college, and it really wasn't until I got out of college and I started thinking about what I wanted to do with space program, doing something in the space program. And at the time I had a job that was at, I worked for IBM in Manhattan. It was a great job, great place to work, but now for me it was just maybe for something a little bit different. So I decided to go to grad school. I had this great opportunity to go to MIT, and I took that, and things just started to gel at that point. So you never know what things can lead you, but the point is that when you find something you're interested in, even if it sounds like it's impossible or really hard or, you know, it's tough, I'm so finished getting sleep already. Do you want to go to bed? Does it even that? If there's something you find that you're interested in doing, I would pursue it because, you know, it can work out. It worked out for me, and I've been very, very happy. So keep that in mind. Don't shy away from something you're interested in, even though it's tough or it sounds crazy. Being an astronaut sounded pretty crazy at the time that I first started thinking about trying to do it, but it all worked out. Anyway, that's my patch. These are names of all the folks I went to space with. And what we did is we went up to the Hubble Space Telescope. That's what it looked like when we arrived. I don't know if you can connect in the lecture. Can you see the images better? Anybody up there? Do we got anybody upstairs?
Yeah, just
home. Okay, yeah, I think it's just in the background light so you can see the pictures a little better. It seems like it kind of can't really see very well. Can you see the light? Okay, that's good. There you go. All right. That's what it looks like. Looks a lot better. All right. These are the folks I went into space with. This is a picture of us training at the Kennedy Space Center. We were assigned on this mission together in October 31st. It was Halloween of 2006. So it took us to finally get into space. We had a couple delays, May of 2009. So for over 2.5 years, we were training together. And you really get to know each other very well, become like a family. Which, of course, everybody knows there's some good things and some bad things for the family, but you get to know each other very well. And for us, it was mainly good. We got along pretty well. We're at the Kennedy Space Center inside of an armored personnel carrier. What we're practicing here is that if the space shuttle has a problem on launch day, we're inside of it, and there's no one, they don't want to send anybody out to come get us, because something really bad may happen. We go into these slide wire baskets, slide down to a bunker, and then we can get inside of this vehicle and safely get away from the space shuttle. And you practice driving this thing. It's actually kind of fun to drive. And we took this photo with Megan MacArthur, who was a flight engineer. She's an oceanographer. She was driving at the time. Megan is quite a few years younger than the rest of us. All the rest of us were about the same age, but Megan was a bit younger. So she used to tell people she was flying with her 6 older brothers. So she felt about it. And sometimes in cruise, she would say her 6 annoying older brothers. Is what she would describe us. So there's Megan in front driving. Back on the left side is John Grunfeld, who was our lead spacewalker. John is a physicist, an astrophysicist. I'm standing next to him. In front of me is Mike Good. We call him Bueno. He's an Air Force colonel, and he was my partner for our spacewalks. Next to him, going to the right, is Greg Johnson, who was a pilot. He's a Navy test pilot. Going a little further, next to Greg is Drew Foysel, who is a very fun guy. I'll show you some pictures and some videos of Drew. He and I had a lot of fun together in space and during our training. He was a spacewalker as well, and he was paired with John. We had 2 spacewalk teams. And then on the far right is our commander, Scott Altman, who is a Navy pilot, and he flew in the movie Top Gun, which, you know, of course, before an aviation museum. So let's open up the mic. Let's stand by. How's that? Sorry. He flew in the movie Top Gun. Anybody see the movie Top Gun?
Yeah.
Scooter is the real Tom Cruise. He actually is in the credits of the movie. He flew the F-14 scenes. He even at one point had the Maverick helmet on him that you see in the movie. It's actually him with the Maverick helmet on, and he's got a lot of good stories of filming that movie. So that was that crew. We did a lot of training for the flight, and a lot of I don't know if I call it the most important, but some of the most important stuff we did was spacewalking. in addition to lodging and landing and the other stuff. And we practiced many, many hours in a big pool down at the Johnson State Center in Houston. They're in a suit, getting ready to be lowered into the water. The pool is gigantic. It's 200 feet long, 100 feet wide, and 40 feet deep. We can fit a mock-up model of a telescope and the station or the space station inside of there. And we go down there and we're able to use our tools and work just like we would in space. So it really prepares you to do your work in space. It does not prepare you to see the wonderful views that are around you while you're working in space. This is a mock-up that I spent a lot of time with that was not in the pool. This was actually up in our office. And I'm working on practicing a repair of an instrument called SIT, or the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph. And normally what we do, and I'll show you some of this, is that we take a large instrument out and replace it with a full-size replacement for it. We haven't before our mission tried to actually fix something. So in other words, if you have your refrigerator and a light bulb goes out, you just pull out the old refrigerator and put a new one in. You don't change anything out. Well, we had some instruments that had broken, and we didn't have big replacements for them, so the plan was to repair these instruments in space, pull off these panels and get inside of the instrument, pull out circuit boards and put new ones in. And to do that, I had to loosen 117 small screws that had washers on them. So we had to put this big capture plate on top of the instrument, had to attach that, and then remove all these fasteners. The thing I want to point out to you, though, you see this little red dot I'm trying to get work here. See down there? See it down there? There's a stanchion down here, and there's one up there, and my pointer's not working up there for some reason, but there's a gold stanchion up at the top on the right. Between those two things was a handrail that needed to be removed. It's not in this picture. It was easy to remove in training, but it gave us some trouble in space, and I'll point that out later. This is a picture of Atlantis on the left and Endeavour's on the right. We had two space shuttles on the launch pad for us. We made sure we got to the right one. We needed to go to Atlantis. But we were not going to the International Space Station, so if we had a problem with our spaceship and couldn't get back home, we'd have to stay at the telescope, whereas when people go to the space station, they can stay at the space station safely for a while until a rescue ship can come get us. In our case, we didn't have that much time. We only had about 20 days where we could live at the telescope, and we needed a rescue crew to come get us. So we had a rescue space shuttle on the pad ready to come get us, with a crew that was in quarantine ready to come get us if we had any trouble. Luckily, we didn't have any trouble, and we were able to not have to worry about coming to space to get us. So we appreciate those guys hanging around ready to help us. And I've got some video of the launch for you now.
Houston, you are go for orbit op.
Houston, I can change the
banners. Houston, Atlantis, good work. Go for orbit op. Thank you.
Okay.
So that was our launch. And you could hear the voices. The voices you heard were some of them were coming from Houston, our spacecraft communicator, Capcom, Greg Johnson. And there's another guy named Greg Johnson, believe it or not. There are two pilots named Greg Johnson. Box is the guy with, you know, that's his nickname. He was on the ground. And Ray J was the nickname for the guy who was with us. But, you know, that's the voice you heard from the Mission Control Center talking to our crew, primarily Scott Alden, our commander. Making calls as we were going up to space. The experience of launch is quite interesting. It's you wait there for a couple hours, and then you count down, keeps going, and then you finally get down to a few seconds. The main engine's light first at 6 seconds, and then the shuttle kind of leans back and comes forward, and then at zero, the solid rockets, the two big white rockets on the side, light, and then you go. There's nothing that's going to stop it, pretty much. And the feeling that you get, the way I would describe it with just two words, is speed and power. It is an amazing ride. It's as if you've been grabbed by some great beast and it's taking you for a ride, and you don't have much to do to say about it. You just pray that everything's going okay and try to enjoy it, because it's an amazing ride. It's just a huge rush of power. We go from zero to 17,500 miles an hour in only 8.5 minutes. So it's an extreme amount of controlled violence is how I would try to describe it, but it's a very cool thing to do. I'm going to show you some another video now. This is of our rendezvous and our capture of the telescope.
Lift all in -25, 151 feet.
Okay, I don't want to see the numbers get bigger.
So this is from our third day in space.
Down there, KU right now, we see that. Thank you.
The first two we launched, and we checked stuff out the second day. Third day, we cast up with the telescope, and then Scott Alden flies our shuttle within just inches of the telescope, really, going very fast.
Houston, Atlanta.
And then Megan successfully grabbed it.
On board the Atlanta.
With the robot.
And it's Houston, we copy. Nice job, Megan. Nice job, and the product's up flying as well. It's great to be back with the telescope.
All right, so everyone was happy.
Thanks, Sam. Everybody's very excited up here, I can tell you.
Because after we got the telescope, we got the spacewalk on it for the next 5 days. This is a picture from our first spacewalk. John Grunstall's on the left and helping put his pants on. And Drew Forstall is on the right. He's in his fancy long underwear on the right, getting ready to go into a suit. There I am helping John, and Mike Good is behind us there. So we did 5 spacewalks. It was 5 days in a row. We had the two teams. So John and Drew went out on days 1, 3, and 5, and then Mike and I went out on days 2 and 4. And I'll show you some shots and some videos from the spacewalks. On our first spacewalk, we placed the wide field camera, which is an instrument that takes those really cool pictures that you see on calendars, you know, these amazing views of space that come from the telescope. And we were replacing with an updated version of the camera that can increase Hubble's discovery potential by a factor of 10. So we can see 10 times further, faster into the universe. And the science is very excited about getting this new camera on. It was our number one science objective, was to install this camera. Gave us a little bit of trouble because there was a bolt that was a little sticky on it. And Drew had to very carefully break the torque on the bolt without breaking the drive rod on the bolt. And it all worked out. But it was a little troublesome there for a while, but it all worked out fine. On the second spacewalk, Mike Good and I were outside. That's Mike upside down on the left, and I'm on the right. Mike in his hands has a rib extension unit, which has these two gyros inside of them, which are things that spin and point the telescope very, very accurately so that I can take these wonderful pictures. On our third spacewalk, John and Drew went back outside, and they replaced an instrument called ProStar, which Drew is on the robot arm there with COSTAR in his hands. COSTAR stands for Corrective Optics Space Telescope Actual Replacement. If anybody remembers back when the telescope was first launched in 1990, the telescope couldn't see very well. It had an aberration in its mirror. And in order to correct that aberration in the mirror, they installed this instrument, which had a series of lenses that went to the light path of the telescope and corrected the vision. So this is a thing that corrected the original problem. It was an original problem with the telescope that was corrected by this instrument on the right. Now, it wasn't needed anymore. After all these years, they were able to put that correction into the new instrument, and they replaced it with another working instrument that could do science. On the fourth spacewalk was Mike Good and I again outside. We were repairing the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph. What you can see in this picture as well is you can see the Earth. There's the dark part of the Earth and the sunlit part of the Earth. And we go around the planet every 90 minutes. So every 45 minutes, we either get a sunrise or a sunset. And in a 24-hour period, we get 16 of these. So you're outside spacewalking, you can see a sunrise coming. You can actually feel it because the sun, when you're in the sunlight, it is warm and extremely bright. It's the whitest bright I've ever experienced being in the sunlight. Well, as soon as you get into darkness, it's the darkest dark I've ever experienced. It's the absence of light, really. You just have your little helmet lights to light up your work area. And you can see this coming. When you're over the dark part of the Earth where it's nighttime and you're starting to come close to where the sun is, you can feel it. You can feel the warmth coming, and then you look and you can see the line. You can actually see that line where it's dark and where it's light. There's the filter experience nighttime, and you can see the planet moving, and you can see that line tracking as the sun is rising over the Earth. It's pretty cool. This is some video from
there's a reflection in the.
This shot comes from my helmet camera.
He prepares to open the doors, protective doors over the fixed head star trackers and the rate sensor unit.
So a lot of these shots come from the helmet. We actually have cameras on our helmets that record a lot of this stuff.
The helmet cam, this view from Michael Good looking into the telescope at Mike Massimino.
Hey Mike, I got it.
Well, we're replacing those gyroscopes, the rate sensor units that come with the telescope. We're replacing those in this.
Michael Good now seating the new heart rate sensor unit.
Nice
job. Houston 3DA, we have a good aliveness test in RSU 2R. You have a go for RSU 3.
So Mike was kind of happy that we had that one. What we're doing now is I'm putting the changing out the battery. The big black box that Mike is working on is a battery module.
Door have been engaged.
These are big batteries.
And back to the telescope.
This is from the fourth segment. Remember I mentioned the bar I had trouble with. This is what was going on in the cabin when I was having trouble with getting that bar off. And there I am trying to get this one screw. I got one of the three out of four screws easily, but this last one is giving me trouble. I just couldn't get it to go.
Darn handrail.
Here's my buddy Drew.
You ready for this?
So he told me just to rip the thing off.
Okay,
so
we'll get it. Here we go.
Yeah, it's really fun doing that.
What is the dramatic part of the EVA tube? First, we start off wide field camera. Oh, yeah, our main objective. The old one might not come out. We almost break the drive rest. Then we can't get our RSUs in. It goes long. Then you're out there and you got a bar that you had to break off manually.
Right.
What's up with you? Is that high tech? No. It'll be in my garage.
Yeah, so my commander kind of summed it up. I asked him what he thought about these spacewalks, and that was his answer. But it all kind of worked out. This is a picture after I broke the bar off and fixed the instrument. I was happy. I was willing to come and take a picture by the window smiling. But it's just magnificent being out there. When you're looking through the windows of the shuttle at the Earth, when you first arrive in space, it's kind of like, I make the analogy that you're you're kind of like looking at an aquarium, you know, through a window, and you're wearing regular, in fact, this is a shirt that I wore when I was in space. You're wearing a shirt like this, and you might be eating something, you can go to the bathroom if you want. It's kind of like you're looking at, ooh, look at the pretty fish. But then when you view the beautiful Earth, when you put on your spacesuit and go spacewalk, now it's like being a scuba diver, and you actually feel like you're out there interacting with the environment. And it is just magnificent. When we took this particular photo, it was at the end of my second spacewalk, and we had finished the day successfully, and my partner, Mike Good, was out there still finishing up some things, and I was pretty much out of stuff to do, so my commander reminded me just to take it easy and enjoy the view, and that's what I did. I hung out by the airlock waiting for my partner for about 20 or 30 minutes, and I just enjoyed the view. And from our altitude, we can see the Earth as a big round ball. You know, it takes up your whole field of view. It's huge. It's not like you're at the moon and it's small, but you know, you're still up close to it, so it's big, but you can see it as a planet. You can see the entire Earth in front of you, which is really awesome. And I got to just enjoy that for that those last 30 minutes or so of the spacewalk. And we picked it up over, we were over in the Pacific, over Hawaii. It was sunny out, at this time it was nice and bright, I could see everything, and came over the Baja Peninsula, California. It only takes 11 minutes to go coast to coast, so 11 minutes later, tracked over the U.S., 11 minutes later, we were over Miami, more or less, over Florida, and then over the Atlantic, and then I could see night coming, and it got dark. And it was time to come in at that time anyway. But it's just wonderful to be able to view the Earth from a spacewalk at that altitude. The fifth and final spacewalk, John and Drew were outside for it. They put their new guidance sensor in and finished up everything we needed to do. We completed all the objectives we had. We're very happy that we were successful. And we then got to say goodbye to the telescope after our five spacewalks, and this is what it looked like. Pretty much the same. We were very happy that we had done our jobs and that we thought anyway the thing was going to still work. We didn't know of anything we did to break it. You don't really know until you see the actual pictures, and I'll show you some of those too. But this is what it looked like when we let go of the telescope after our fifth spacewalk. My favorite thing to do is look out the window. We got very lucky, and depending on how you look at it, I thought we were lucky that we had bad weather in Florida, so we couldn't land the first few days we were supposed to land. And, you know, we got dressed up and ready to come home, and they said, nah, the weather's no good, we're going to try again tomorrow. So we just had to do a couple things. We had to turn the toilet back on and turn the galley back on so we could eat. Take off our big spacesuits. But other than that, we had nothing to do. And I just enjoyed listening to music, looking out the window. I got to send some of these tweets from space and in my free time. And this happened a second day as well. So we got 2 free days in space just to enjoy being up there and view the Earth. And this is some video of Ian Nixon, who is our flight engineer, and Megan. What are you doing now?
Well, it's just a starboard survey of the orbiter of CPS, and we don't get much. So I got this rocket here that says MSC Meals on it, just pull it out. It shows me all the food with the green dots lying in the air. So I look up kind of what I want to eat. This is what I was looking for, ravioli.
Oh, man, it was great.
Very tasty.
I just had some. Galileo's telescope, 2009 was the 400th anniversary of Galileo's observations of the solar system. And if you ask some historians, science historians, you know, what the greatest telescope ever built was, the most significant telescope, there's a pretty good chance they would tell you it was Galileo's telescope. And it was appropriate, I think, to fly this year, last year, 2009, because of the 40th anniversary, and because we were going to the Hubble Space Telescope, which is arguably the best telescope we have ever since Galileo's telescope. So what we had is Hubble in the background on our payload bay. We had the replica of Galileo's telescope on the flight deck. So these two great telescopes were flying together in space. And it was pretty cool having this thing. I don't know how Galileo was able to do what he did with that telescope. And you can see stuff through it, but he was able to, the discoveries he made with that were really, really incredible. But it was kind of fun to have that on board with us. Also for you Mets fans, right now the Yankees had a much better season, but this is a home plate that I took with me from Shea Stadium. And they got down Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium the same year, and a friend of mine, Garrett Reeson, who's from New Jersey, he's an astronaut who flew dirt on the pitcher's mound in Yankee Stadium. And I called my friend from the Mets, and I go, "Do you hear about this guy who's flying his dirt from Yankee Stadium in space?" And he said, "Yeah, Mike, don't worry, we can do better than dirt." And they shipped me this whole plate. One thing you'll notice about the plate, though, is when I first offered the plate, I measured our lockers. We have these lockers on the shuttle where we can store stuff. And they measure 17 3/4 inches in width. And when I look at the dimensions of a major league plate, of a baseball home plate, it measures 17 inches across, which is a little bit less than 17 3/4. So we made a little mock-up. This is NASA, after all. We built a little model out of cardboard. And we tested it. We said, yes, this thing will fit in the plate. But what we didn't account for was a piece of black rubber that is along the sides of the plate, which adds an inch in each direction, which now makes it for you mathematicians 19 inches and too big to fit inside of this locker that we had. So we actually, this is a very long story, but I'm trying to shorten it. I called the plate manufacturer. They sent me a couple practice plates because I didn't want to cut that one up to see what I could do. So I got, this is really cool. It had all these cleat marks on it and dirt from the games, and it was cool. We were able to slice off the black around the plate and just fly the white part, and then we didn't tell the team about this, of course. And then we got back, we were able to glue back the plate. My buddy and I, another astronaut friend, we glued the black, and I gave it back to the Mets this past July. So it didn't really help them much with their season, but it was kind of fun to have the player on board. But I got to slide into it in space, you know, so after our fun and games in space, lots, it was time to come back home, and this is a photo of our spacesuits that we used when we launched, and it was time to get those out and get that good for landing. So I said we had two extra days where we got dressed, and they told us, nah, forget it. But on that third day that we attempted, we were able to come back home, and I have some video now to show you interviewing some of my crewmates and then the landing itself as well. I'm going to be watching
too.
You're going to be watching sooner.
Right.
What are you going to be looking for?
Well, we'd be looking to see that all the milestones as we come around to that heading alignment cone and to make sure he's on at the 180, so that's 180 degrees to
this way. About the big turn that we made before we turn final onto the land, onto the runway.
You can let me fly a little bit, and I'll fly around that cone with you. Yeah,
okay. All right.
But then I'm going to make sure he's on his altitude, you know, runway, then 90 degrees out from the runway,
right.
And he rolls on final, it's all at altitude.
Right.
Airspeed's right, altitude right, getting ready to land.
And if he's not, you're going to let him know.
Then I'm going to give him some sugar cold.
All right, okay. What is sugar cold?
Little rise, little up.
All right.
Little fast, little slow.
Okay.
You can do it. You're the man.
Tomorrow's a big day for you. And then you've had all kinds of big days, but it's tomorrow kind of the biggest day for you.
Because
the robot doesn't land. That's right. There's no auto land system here. at Edwards Air Force Station. The weather was continually bad in Florida. We landed over in California, and it was really cool. I was on the flight deck for the launch. I was on the mid deck, so I didn't have a window. But on the on landing, I swapped places with Mike Good. So I was on the flight deck, and I got to see out the window, which was kind of fun for our entry. And it really is magnificent. You come down, the shuttle starts to glow. Hopefully you saw it in the video, the tail of the orbiter kind of glowing red hot. And then you break out kind of below that that part of the atmosphere, and you can pick up the horizon again. And you can see the coast of Florida from the coast of California from a couple hundred miles away. And it's just as beautiful, and everything worked out fine. We were pretty sure that we did our jobs right, but you never really know until you get to see the pictures from the telescope. And I have some of them for you here, and I'm going to read you some numbers that go along with these photos. What we're looking at here is Omega Centauri. Now, I have three images to show you. They were like kind of test images that they used. And when we got back in May, they started to power up the telescope and check everything out, and they do it very slowly. So it took a few months until they were able to start gathering images. And these were just the first couple, just to make sure everything was working. But they're still pretty spectacular. So we saw these in September, they were released. This one is Omega Centauri. And what you're looking at in this one image is 100,000 stars. They're actually part of a larger cluster of stars. So this continues. This is just a small section. There's 100,000 of nearly 10 million stars that are in the whole cluster that's out there in this area. And this is 16,000 light years away. So this is 16,000 light years away from us. So traveling at the speed of light, it would take you 16,000 years to get there. And these stars are between 10 and 12 billion years old. So that's Omega Centauri. And another one of the first images was this, which is Cepheus Quintet. And there's five galaxies there. What's interesting is that this is one little piece of the sky, but they're able to pick up these five galaxies. Four of them are kind of the same distance away. They're about 300 million light years away. But the brighter one on the upper left is only 40 million light years away. So even though they're in the same tiny bit of sky, when you look up with the telescope, one of those galaxies is much closer than the other four. The two in the middle there are actually colliding, two colliding galaxies. I've got one more for you. This one is the Butterfly Nebula. It's a dying star, and it's in our galaxy. It's in the Milky Way, so it's relatively close. It's only 3,800 light years away. And if you measured this thing, if you tried to go across it, at the speed of light, it would take you 2 years. So it's 2 light years in length, and that's the Butterfly Nebula. So that's the last prepared picture. Can we bring the lights up? Okay, so I think we have some time for some questions.
Yeah. How long will the Hubble function now since it's been repaired?
Everyone hear the question?
No.
Your question is, how long will the Hubble function since it's been repaired? Well, like I said, we don't have any warranty on it. We don't warranty any of our labor. But we're hoping, we're hoping that we'll get another 5 to 10 years out of it. I think we will.
Follow up. Who made the tools?
The question was, who made the tools? We have several different contractors that made the tools. There was a contractor. It used to be called Swales, and now I think it's Johnson Engineering. I can't remember. They got changes switched out up at the near the Goddard Space Flight Center. I work at the Johnson Space Center, and that's where we train and do a lot of our work. But we also work closely with a bunch of the engineers over at the Goddard Space Flight Center, and they had a local contractor that make a lot of our tools. We had a new power tool, a small little power tool that we use, a little small small screws that we had to get out of there. They're actually 115 new tools that were developed. And that was anything from, you know, special things that had to, for just capturing all this stuff. We had, you know, like a little clip that had to be captured, and another stanchion to remove the handrail. Those stanchions had special tools that go on top of there. And very, a lot of them were very special, one of a kind type of one purpose only tools that were designed specifically to do some of these repairs. And others were more generic, but there was about 115 new ones developed. Nice.
What was the distance from Earth?
We were 350 miles up, which is as far as the space shuttle can go with the propellant we have in our orbital maneuvering system, which allows you to, the big engines get you up part of the way, you know, about 150 miles or so. And that's when you launch and you stop. You know, your orbital engines cut. And then you get to the altitude of the orbit you need to go at, you engage these orbital maneuvering system engines, which then boost you up to the higher orbit. But you also need these things to come home. So you need to have enough propellant left so that you can burn those engines so that it'll degrade your orbit so you can come home. And if you add all that up, you won't have enough fuel to come back, of course. You want to be around a round trip ticket. You can go 350 miles, which is the highest that the shuttle can fly. And that's why the telescope is up that high. You want the great thing about the telescope is that it's above the atmosphere. And the further you can get from the Earth, the better off you're going to be as far as being able to see things, not have the Earth struck what you're looking at, and not cause any trouble. So you want to be as far as you can away from the Earth. And so that's why the telescope is that high.
How long will it maintain that orbit?
It'll stay in that orbit, hopefully, at least for another 20 years, which when they initially launched the telescope, they more or less signed up that they wouldn't let it come down and hit anything, that it would have a safe reentry. The initial plan was to send a shuttle up at the very end of its life, at the end of life of the telescope, and fold it up and bring it back home, fold up the solar arrays, put it back in the payload bay, and bring it home. But it's very expensive to launch space shuttles. They figured that out. It wasn't as expensive back then. They were getting a discounted deal. So the reality of it makes it really expensive. So what we did on our mission was we put a docking module, a docking ring, really, not a module, but a little ring on the bottom of the telescope. We attached it to it. If you look very closely, I showed before and after pictures, you couldn't see the difference, but if you look really closely, you would see a ring at the bottom of the telescope when we let go of it. And the plan is to have some type of rocket, a rocket on top of an unmanned launch vehicle, nobody on board, launch up this rocket motor, attach it to the bottom of the telescope so that you could guide it back, a guided entry into the ocean as opposed to into some land. So, it'll decay, but we have about 20 years at least to start thinking about how we're going to prevent it from causing trouble. Go ahead.
Do you have any specific mentor that helped?
I'm sorry, pointing over here, but that's okay. We'll get you next. Man in the hat. We'll get you next. All right, go ahead.
Any specific mentor that helped you during that time between high school and college?
Oh, I had lots of them. Are you feeding me a line? Is there somebody here with those messages? Yeah, if there's any specific mentor that helped me out, I had lots of mentors. My parents were good mentors. Oh, my friend Jim McDonald, do you have a chance? I don't know if he's here, but he was a guy I worked with at CERN, and he was a good friend of mine and encouraged me. A lot of my friends are here who helped me out. I see Mike Lubicato over there. Yeah, you went, Barry, and kicked him. Anyway, I had a lot of good friends that encouraged me. Probably my parents and my wife with my girlfriend at the time. But it's very important to have good mentors to help you out as you're growing up. My president.
To avoid another situation like in Colombia, what sort of precautions should you guys take up there to check bomb strikes?
Yeah, there weren't anywhere here. It was to prevent another problem we had with the Colombia accident. Now, the one thing they did is the problem with Colombia was that foam came off that tank and hit the wing and made a hole in it. So, first step is to try to build the tank so stuff doesn't come flying off of it. So they redesigned the tank. The stuff still comes off of the tank. There's nothing they really could do to improve it to the point where you didn't have to worry about any debris coming off. But they did a pretty good job of reducing it. So now it's minimal debris, let's say, coming off it. So that was one step that they did. The other thing is that we have a lot of photographic capability. The shots that you saw on Ascent, looking back from the shuttle, we didn't always have those shots. But they put those, not just it gives you cool footage, you know, it's kind of cool to see that view, but it also gives a way to monitor what's going on the shuttle. You can see stuff flying off, and if it hits something, you can pick it up on those cameras. So we monitor with those cameras. Then once we get to orbit, we do an inspection. The first thing we do, we started actually on the first day, we started to inspect everything to see if there was any damage anywhere. You know, particularly on along the wing, the leading edge of the wing, which takes a lot of the heat and is kind of fragile. We inspected that. That's where Columbia got hit. So we do an inspection of that, the underbelly, everything, make sure everything's good. And then we do our mission. And at the higher altitude where we were Hubble, you got to worry about, at any altitude, you have to worry about getting hit with something. And you can track stuff, you know, an object about the size of a bocce ball. They can track that stuff. And if they see you possibly hitting something like that, you can do a maneuver and try to avoid it. But the smaller stuff can do a pretty good wallopy as well, because everything's going so fast. They can't track that. So we're up to a higher altitude, which is a riskier altitude for those days when we spacewalk. Once we got rid of the telescope, we lowered our orbit, even though we were still going to stay up. So it was a little bit, sort of reduced the risk that way. And then before we came home, we did another inspection of the vehicle to make sure everything still was good, that we didn't knock into anything that we didn't know about during the mission. And then after that, they let those guys go home that were waiting to come get us if they needed to. And we're, so that, those are the things that that we did. If you find something wrong, we also have the potential of going out and doing a spacewalk and trying to fix it. Well, I don't know, I'm not sure how well that would actually work, but you have at least have an opportunity to try to repair any damage that's there. Way in the back.
HBO just did a reenactment of the Mercury Apollo mission. It was really exciting, and I'm wondering what the future of NASA will be. Are we going to send people that far again?
You said it was Mercury and Apollo that did it?
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen this. This is a new program?
It's an HBO series of enactments.
It's
really exciting.
I hope we go. I mean, our plan or our hope is to go back to the moon and use it as kind of a test bed for people living off our planet on another
planet, even though it's
not officially a planet,
it's the moon.
Okay. It's not officially a planet, it's the moon. It is the planetary body that we can sort of practice on and as a stepping stone to go to, you know, maybe Mars or somewhere else. I hope we'll do that. I think we will. The shuttle program is ending now. We're going to stop flying space shuttles to the space station. This is the last mission to Hubble. We have 5 more flights. Our next launch is February 7th, and by the end of the year, we should be done with flying the space shuttle after 135 flights. So that'll be over with. And then what we'll be doing for the next few years is flying a Soyuz along with our Russian partners and the European Space Agency and the Japanese, and so it's all international program. But the only way to get to space with people is going to be on the Russian rocket, that spaceship, for the next few years until we build another spaceship. And we do have another spaceship under design that we are working on. You know, we'll see what happens. There's also these commercial groups that are flying people into space for tourism and stuff. There's a possibility we might be able to use their spaceship to go to the space station, and then NASA would concentrate on the moon and beyond. I think we're going to be doing something. I don't know if we know exactly what it's going to be with the change of administration and, you know, new people in different leadership positions, but, you know, we still plan to build this follow-on spaceship to replace the shuttle as our way to get into space. And hopefully that'll be able to go to the space station, to the moon, and beyond. But we'll see how long it takes. Go ahead, sir.
How confident were you with that tile repair kit?
How confident were they with the tile repair kit? That's for repairing the tile. If we had a strike and we had a damage to the tile. It was worth a shot. quite honestly, I was really hoping we didn't have any trouble because I do a lot of spackling around the house, and it doesn't. A lot of these holes, that's where we fill a lot of these holes. You take this goo and you put it in there and you're doing this in zero gravity and you're not really very stable. But theoretically, it would work. But I didn't want to have to put that to the test with our lives on the line to make sure that thing worked. So
NASA test that here on the ground?
Yeah, they almost tested. In fact, they tested it in space as well. But, having said that, my spackling technique wasn't the greatest, and I was looking. So, I mean, it should work. Theoretically, it should work, and I'm sure it would. I mean, it gives you something to try if you did have that kind of damage. So, yeah, I think we were really hoping that we wouldn't have to use it. I'm glad we didn't, but if we did, I think we would have been okay. So, cool. We got a lot of questions. Oh, and the fact that the hat and the blues. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you feel that your training was adequate for your space flight, or was there anything that you
tried
to try?
I think our training was really good. Like I said, pulling off that handrail was something we could ever imagine was going to... We thought of every problem. We practiced in the pool many, many times, and I practiced on my own in our office simulator that we had there. And I never once had that problem with that big bolt, but we got a lot of other things going wrong in training. And I think in general, like in life, you can't really know what's going to go wrong, but it's how you handle the problem. And so you have a lot of things go wrong in training, and you're not necessarily practicing that particular problem, but you're practicing how to solve a problem. You know what I mean? So it's very important not to get too excited or overly depressed. There was a saying that I learned on my first flight from one of my veteran crewmates, which was, no matter how bad things seem to be, you can make them worse. And it's a pretty good thing to keep in mind. Like, oh man, this is really bad, but you can make it a lot worse if you do something to make it worse. So these are all things that we experienced in our training, even though we didn't have those exact problems. We had other problems that we didn't anticipate, but we had worked together with our folks, the people on the ground, to help us. So, yeah, we were very well trained. Go ahead.
I was wondering, the EVAs, how much your workout is it, and do you lose any weight, and how many calories do you burn in the EVAs?
I don't know how much. I'm not sure how much you sweat a lot. You generally lose weight in space. Your appetite goes down a little bit. I think what generally happens is your appetite kind of decreases and you're busy and you've got a lot of things to do and a fair amount of stress. And so you maybe lose a little bit, and you tend to gain it back toward the end as you get back on a more normal pace for yourself after the space loss, for example. But it's a pretty big workout.
I mean, does it work out to do all the tools? I mean, is that the kind of workout in space
that's possible? You're working against the suit. I mean, the bulk of the suit, and it's fairly long. The space loss we had one that was over 8 hours. That's the time that we turned our battery on and left the airlock until the time we got back. We're in the suit that day for about 10 hours because it was about 45 minutes or an hour ahead of time that you're in, and then it takes a little while to pull you out of there. So, it could be pretty tiring. It's pretty much nonstop action. So, it's a pretty good workout. In the back.
Mike, what's your next adventure, or what would you like your next adventure to be?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of something clever. I was pretty first adventurous driver. I was in Manhattan before, and that New York City taxi cab ride that I had were pretty. I was trying to use my BlackBerry in there, and I started getting motion sick. Worse than I ever got in space. I don't know. I've been lucky enough to fly in space 2 times. There's a chance I can have an opportunity again. I feel very happy with what I've got a chance to do. But I'm still available. I'm still an astronaut working for NASA. We'll see what happens. I'd be happy to go again. I don't feel the real urgency. I'm not, burning desire to go like I did before my first one. And even after my first one, I really wanted to go back again for a second one. I wouldn't mind going back, but I'm a little bit older now. My kids are getting older in high school. It's pretty pretty stressful on your family as well to go through this whole experience. There's a cost associated with doing this over and over again, and I really love my job. I can still be an astronaut without flying in space, so we'll see what happens. You know, maybe I'll get a chance to go in the next couple of years, or maybe I'll have to wait a bit longer, or maybe it's over. I don't know yet, but I'm going to stay and ask until they kick me out, which hopefully will be a little bit longer. The young person there in the red shirt. Yeah.
Has anything
done on Wednesday? Who is that up there? Is that your father looks familiar? Is that your father on the right? Who's that next to you? What's your name? Is that Sal?
Sal.
Sal Lepicco. I got my girl just hiding in the audience over here. My cousin Sal Lepicco with his daughter having a seat. All right, Sal, are you okay? All right, there he is right there. I'm sorry, Melissa. Did anything go wrong or what happened?
Has anything gone wrong on launch day?
Yeah, well, some things have gone wrong. We had actually today is the anniversary of the Challenger accident, which is was 1980. It was 24 years ago that the Challenger accident happened. So yeah, we've had some bad things happen on launch day. We also have time. You know, sometimes we're ready to launch and they find something they don't like and they stop, and we try another day. So yeah, some things have happened. Only one really bad thing has happened on launch day when we lost the whole vehicle. Usually we're able to detect what the problem is, but there are many times you go down to the launch and everyone gets loaded inside of the spaceship and something for whatever reason they don't like, and they're very, very conservative. They don't like to take too many risks. So hopefully we won't have any more bad things on launch day happen to us. In the white shirt.
How high is the spaceship when
it
launches from the launch pad?
How high is the spaceship? Like, how high are we above the ground when we launch? We're about 200 feet up from where we're sitting to where the bottom of the launch pad is. 195 feet to be exact. So. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, Mike, welcome home. Mike, the videos were great. They were very informative and a lot of fun. How did you get to do all that? That was great.
The videos, the interviews...
on YouTube and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, no, they were... the stuff from the flight, you mean? Or the, yeah. You've done some stuff after, it's been fun. The flight videos, though, each crew decides to document their flight a little bit differently. Some have, you know, they have footage and then they narrate it. You know, I think that's what this next crew plans to do. I just thought that was too much work because you have to film it and then you have to watch it and narrate it as it goes to the ground. I was like, I forget this. So I figured the easier thing to do would just be to talk to my crewmates about what they were doing. And then half the time I didn't even view it unless it was something that I needed to cut. So, you know, but then I just, you know, I just filmed them, asked them what they were doing and what they were feeling too, so people can kind of get to know us as people, sort of, if they were interested in doing that. And I just shipped it to the ground. So actually it was... It's kind of minimal work. It wasn't that at all. It was kind of fun. It was fun for all of us to do that. So
I thought it was great.
I'm glad you liked it. Go ahead.
When you unfastened all the screws and I think they were floating around in the catch pole.
Wait, who's this guy now, Pat?
My brother.
Is your brother over here?
Hey, Chad, what's he doing?
I want everyone to introduce themselves now because I'm there's a Frank over here. That's how I saw Frank. He was about 14 years old. All right, so go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah. Unfastened all the screws and they went inside the catch plate. They were floating around.
They were, yeah.
How'd you get them back in the hole?
Ah, we didn't have to worry about that. See, what happened is that that thing was buttoned up to survive a space shuttle launch. When they launched that that instrument inside of the telescope, they had all these screws, 117 of them, to put this plate up into the instrument and keep everything nice and tight inside of it. But they didn't really have that requirement again. There was also some thermal requirements, believe it or not, with these screws, where the heat from the inside was translated through the screw out to a radiator that was on the front plate as well. So once we removed that thing and we got the bad card out, the bad power supply out, put a new one in, we didn't have to put all those screws in. We just put a replacement. We put another plate on top there, a cover plate, that had these two lever arms that I was able to throw that locked it in. It was really simple. It took a matter of seconds to put it back. But yeah, first we thought we might have to replace some of those screws, and that would have been really a problem. It wasn't, giving them out wasn't that bad. But trying to get those back in those little tiny holes would have been a mess. So,
Mike,
Okay, and the pack with the hat, the younger guy there, the gray shirt, good. What's it like to do that transition? A lot of different. The question was the transition from space, you know, from Earth with more gravity to space without any gravity. A lot of things start happening through your body. One is that your fluid, you know, your all your bodily fluid, your blood and the water that's in your body, is kind of held down by gravity. When you get to space, it all kind of pools up, and everyone gets these big fat heads, like big round. You know, your head gets really puffy and red. You get like an inflammation of your head, and it also stuffs you up a little bit. You feel kind of stuffy. You're just not very comfortable. And you pee a lot because your body thinks it has more fluid than it actually does, and your brain elicits a response for you to urinate more than you normally would. So you got to keep drinking, make sure you're well hydrated. You also everything's floating, including your inner ear, which tells you what's up and down if you're moving, and it works on gravity. And your inner ear does. And if you get a conflict, if you've ever been sick, maybe in a car sick or in a boat or something, what happens, for example, in a car to some people is that if you're reading a book, it sometimes makes it worse. Like I was trying to read my BlackBerry in the cab today and we were moving. Your eyes are telling you that you're standing still because your eyes are still focused on something, but your inner ear is moving, knows you're still moving. And it creates a conflict and can make you feel queasy. And space is kind of the opposite. Your inner ear says you're perfectly still because gravity's not there to have it react to anything. It's just floating. But your eyes, as you move around, say you're moving and can sometimes elicit an upset stomach. So we have that going for us as well. Plus your spine grows in space because gravity keeps that nice and tight on Earth. When you get to space, it grows a little bit. So you get a little back pain. You actually you gain a little height. Our pilot, Ray J, is a shorter guy. He was very excited. You had to measure him in space. He grew an inch and a half. He was all excited. But you lose all that when you come back. So all that happened, you don't really feel that good your first day. But by the second day, it's amazing how the body adapts. It kind of figures out what's going on. Your body, your fluid gets redistributed the way it should be. Your brain kind of adapts to what's going on with the floating around, and you generally don't get any nausea or any sickness after being there for a few hours. So what we found is that the body is very adaptive. You know, when you go up, your brain doesn't know what's going on, and your body needs to adjust itself. But it does that pretty well after about a day or so.
One more?
Sure. Let's see here. We got Let's see. Okay, one of the kids over here. Go ahead, see. Go ahead. Right there. In the way. Hey, what's that?
How big is the shuttle?
The shuttle, the shuttle end to end is a couple hundred feet long. It's like if you got a couple school buses together in a row. That's the size of it. It's pretty big. But the place that we live in inside of the shuttle is kind of like two medium-sized rooms. We have a flight deck and we have a mid-deck. So there's not very much living area in there. But there's enough for seven people to be able to kind of share in there. So the shuttle's pretty well, but we only are able to live in a smaller portion of it.
Let's see. I'm looking. Here we go. Right there in the... Go ahead, buddy.
What's going to be next after the International Space Station?
We're going to be using that for a few more years, hopefully. And then I would hope to see us move on and explore what else is out a little further from our planet than just being close to Earth. Exploring the moon again, but not just to go and get rocks and come back, which is what we did 40 years ago. I'd like to hopefully see us go there and actually settle on the moon and put a laboratory on the moon and have people working there for longer periods of time and change out expedition crews on the moon. That's what we think is the next step to achieve. And I think that's going to happen. It's just a question of how long it takes us to get there. Can we go for one more?
You.
All right, let's take one more. How about our friend in a red shirt right there, everybody?
what happened that you had to go up there and fix it? What happened that made?
Why do we have to go fix the telescope? Yeah, there's a couple things. One is to extend its life. There's really two major reasons. One is to extend its life. Things like the batteries that we replaced, they were starting to go bad. They had been up there for almost 20 years, and they need to be replaced, or else the telescope would have stopped working. Some of the guidance sensors, we had to replace the guidance sensors. Some of the gyroscopes, I thought, but those things wear out. They don't last very long. So they effectively use them all at the same time. They only use two of them at a time, and they switch between them. So the parts just wear out. So to extend the telescope's life, we did replace those things. But the other thing we did is to try to increase its discovery capability. If you think about digital cameras, in the last few years, they've gone from being kind of just a couple of pixels, and now you can get these incredible photographs. You have your own digital camera. Well, that's kind of some of the upgrades we did to the telescope. As new technology comes out, we're able to put that in the telescope. So we also kind of upgrade it. So we extend its life, and we also upgrade its science capability with new technology to help it see further into the universe. So that's why we did it.
So it could see like farther, so it could see closer to like stars.
Yeah, so we can get a better look of what's out there. You can see even further into the universe than what it's seeing now. Getting really, really far out there. So I think we're done.
Yeah.
All right, we're done. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks to Mike Massimino. Two other things. I think we have some members of the 106th Rescue Wing here. Where are they? They're right up there. They're part of the Space Shuttle group in terms of possibly going out and helping out with the Space Shuttle. As you know, they're retiring the Space Shuttle, and they only cost about $28.5 million if we wanted to get one here at the cradle. So anybody who's got spare $1 million, you want to donate it here, we only need 28 of you. Let us know. There's a bucket outside. You can just drop your check in there. But thank you all for coming. We appreciate it, and we'll see you again.